Hello, we're back. This is Left Out on WRCT 88.3. You can give us a call at 412-621-9728 or 412-621-WRCT. On the line, we have Karen Katowski, who is a retired lieutenant colonel from the U.S. Air Force who used to work in the Pentagon, and we've been talking about so far about her impressions of having worked in the Pentagon Office of Special Plans. One of the things that she has a lot more knowledge, a lot more information, and I'd like to touch on a few other topics as we go forward. So one of the points that she made a minute ago is just that the whole propaganda campaign that was generated about going to a war with Iraq and all the excuses were just nonsense. The weapons, the threat, the Al-Qaeda connection, and all those things were just nonsense, and everybody knew they were nonsense. In addition, the question of whether Israel is actually better off because of this war. And so this brings up the natural question is, why did they decide to go to war? Why was that the need? Why are we at war? Why did they want to go to war? So, Karen, if you have any comments or opinions about that, what's the real reason for this?
Well, you know, there's a lot of reasons that they say, and, of course, I think most of those can be discounted. The idea of democracy for Iraqis, this is not something that we're interested in. Certainly, you can see that. 65% of the Iraqis are Shia, and there's a clear possibility that if we had some kind of democracy there,
this
is something that is while it may well be in the interest of the Iraqis, certainly the Shias and others in the region, it is not of interest to either Israel or the United States. And so democracy is not the thing. Liberation of the Iraqi people is nonsense, clearly, because first off, they're not liberated in the least bit, and second off, we have very good friends who are dictators, which are easily as bad to their people as Saddam Hussein was. You know, the guy in Kazakhstan that we seem to be so in love with, in Uzbekistan, I mean, we're using those guys right now. You know, Pakistan is very interesting. You know, the guy in charge of Pakistan, his name escapes me at the moment.
Musharraf.
He actually took over from a democratically elected leader with the passive blessing of the United States, and certainly our relations got better after Musharraf took over and toppled that democratically elected leadership. So we are not in any, we don't care that people have dictators, and we don't care that their dictators treat them badly. That's just not part of our track record, and it's not part of our national interest. So we did not go into Iraq in order to topple Saddam Hussein because he was a dictator. The other reasons that they have, I think, this idea of 1,000 flowers of democracy will grow in the Middle East through some sort of forced transformation. Certainly nonsense. Not even neoconservatives, while they say that, actually believe that. So the reasons we were given, okay, weapons of mass destruction. Weapons of mass destruction exist in many countries around the world, and many of those countries are real threats to the United States in the sense of being able to deliver some of those weapons. Certainly North Korea comes to mind. Pakistan, of course, one of our best friends, was actually helping the North Koreans and others with some of their weapons of mass destruction. In the case of Saddam Hussein, weapons of mass destruction, 96% had been already accounted for and I think for the most part destroyed, certainly accounted for, by the UN process. And that 4% remaining was in some debate. Was it really a 4% that was remaining? Or was that the 4% administrative double counts or whatever? I mean, we in the United States, who actually sold the WMD gave it to Saddam Hussein in those days when he was our friend, we ourselves in this country, with all of our computing systems and all of our great ability to do things in our open society, would be very hard-pressed to account completely for even 96% of all of our weapons of mass destruction.
Point.
So it certainly wasn't about the weapons of mass destruction.
No.
What was the
nonsense.
Other reason? That he had gassed his people? He gassed his people when he was our ally.
Under our aegis, exactly.
Yeah. So the Al-Qaeda linkage. You know, had members of Al-Qaeda passed through Iraq? Certainly, and we had 70 ongoing FBI investigations in this country where members of Al-Qaeda were actually not passing through, but living here and conducting some sort of operation of interest to the FBI. Now, this we know. So certainly Al-Qaeda linkages and 911, of course, had nothing to do with it, but even Al-Qaeda linkages were very not compelling in any case. So what's left? Some people say oil. Some people say contracts for friends of the Bush administration. The things that I see is the primary reason is a geostrategic military basing. We were under huge pressure to leave Saudi Arabia. Of course, we overstayed our welcome back in 1991. One of the things that Bin Laden is upset about is that we stayed in Saudi Arabia militarily. And Saudi Arabian government is under the House of Saud is under huge pressures. So there's huge dichotomies in the society, and it's pretty much there's trouble ahead for Saudi Arabia. And we needed an alternative military location. Iraq is the ideal place for that. Of course, Saddam wasn't going to invite us in. We are already removing troops from Saudi Arabia. So basically, changing our military basing footprint in the Middle East in order to better deal with what we see as future threats, and that would be Syria, that would be Iran, might be Pakistan in the future, certainly could be Saudi Arabia after the House of Saud, if it becomes a Wahhabist fundamentalist regime of some kind. So we needed a way to deal with the Middle East in the long term, and that's through military positioning that's cost-effective for us. There was some even military economic interest in stopping the waste that we were doing with this enforcement of the no-fly zones, a huge, very expensive proposition done primarily by temporary duty personnel, which is very expensive to do. If we have permanent bases and we don't have to enforce the no-fly zone, we actually save resources. So from a military perspective, this was a very practical action to take. Now, since Saddam wasn't going to invite us in, this idea of liberating his people so that we can put in these bases, and I think there's 14 decent-sized bases that are being built with that $67 billion that went to the military, of the $87 billion that was awarded for rebuilding Iraq. $67 billion is military money, and much of that is base-building money. So that's one of the big reasons. There are other reasons. You know, Saddam Hussein, before 9/11, back in November of 2000, he switched his oil for food oil sales from the dollar to the euro.
Right, I was going to mention this. Yeah,
and you know, we're a debtor nation now. We don't have a gold standard. Our major resource that the value of our currency is, one of the major resources, is energy. That's something that everyone around the world wants to have, as you know, in the same way that they might have wanted to have gold in the past. And so, if OPEC and other primary oil producers, non-OPEC oil producers, prefer or choose due to the value of our currency or other reasons, political reasons, to sell on the dollar, what that does is it inspires and motivates central banks and national banks around the world to keep their reserves in dollars so that they can be readily available to convert those into, you know,
buying
energy.
Buying oil or whatever. Yeah.
So when Saddam Hussein, potentially the second largest oil field, certainly not producing at that level, but with the second largest size of oil reserves, second only after Saudi Arabia, decides formally on his own as a sovereign leader in November of 2000 to switch to the euro, that is significant, because it wouldn't be significant if sanctions remained, but the sanctions were not going to remain. I mean, he had clearly cooperated in such a way with the UN that most of the UN membership, certainly not the UK or the US, but most of the others, felt that he had demonstrated good faith, that we understood where the stuff was, and there was much pressure on to lift those sanctions. Certainly the sanctions were reported as hurting the Iraqi people and that kind of thing. So, and they were getting old. I mean, how long can you go on with sanctions?
Yeah.
I mean, Cuba is such an anachronism for the failure of sanctions. And so we didn't want another Cuba, and the world didn't want that. So once those sanctions were lifted, he would not only be producing more oil, and he would be selling it in euros, which is
right,
a really negative
dollar
thing. You remember Venezuela did that a little bit later switched to the euro as well. So there's a lot of interest in switching to the euro again.
And
our currency is based on debt, based on treasury bills that we sell to Asian countries and domestic buyers and Europeans and that. So we have that issue. Now, once sanctions are lifted, who thinks going to get those contracts for rebuilding those oil fields and everything else in that status?
Had we not done this, you mean, yeah.
Sure, it wasn't going to be the United States and the U.K. We had been busy bombing them. It would have been everybody but us. And so more reason why we need to precipitate something before those sanctions were lifted.
Yeah, that brings up a point. So going back a little bit, so I think really what you're saying is within the Pentagon, at least within where you were, it was sort of commonly understood that all of the public stories about why this was happening were baloney.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also clear from what you're saying, and I think it's clear as things have emerged and public statements have been made now, that we have no intention of ending the occupation of Iraq, right? We fully intend to be militarily occupying Iraq.
Well, I think so. Or at least retaining, they're doing whatever we can do to retain our free military access to the landmass of Iraq and to the airspace of Iraq. I mean, you know, is that occupation or, you know, what do you want to call that? I mean, I think it was the neoconservatives certainly could care less if Iraq degenerates into, you know, ethnic or religious strife.
That seems rather likely.
Yeah, well, so long as Iraq as a nation does not gather the kind of autonomous strength or sovereignty that they can challenge us to move our military footprint out of Iraq, as long as they stay weak enough to be unable to either force us to leave or request us through a sovereign, you know, power to leave, then we're going to stay, and that's certainly part of the agenda. We, in fact, you know, who's the guy, Jay Garner, who had gone there? He gave an interview back in February, early February, to published in Government Executive magazine, where he said we'll be there for 20 or more years.
Yeah, I saw that.
And you know, did you see that he said that we need to think of this in terms of the Philippine occupation?
Right.
You remember that?
Yep. Yeah, that's 1898, right.
1898, and then 30 years.
So it's fair to say we'll be having a lot of troops spending time in Iraq for their foreseeable future.
Yeah, exactly.
So another question that kind of some of this touches on, though, is what is the motivation of the United Kingdom in all of this? I think a lot of people are puzzled by why. What's the deal with Tony Blair?
I certainly do not know. I've not studied him. He mystifies me as far as, I mean, you know, I naively, like many people probably, when he'd been very close to Bill Clinton in terms of his politics, this third way kind of.
Yeah, that's
kind of
right.
A,
yeah, they were sort of two of a kind.
Sure. And so I wondered, I mean, I actually was quite surprised at the very beginning when Bush was named, you know, named president and moved into the White House and occupied the organs of government, the administrative part, the executive part. When he did that, I was very surprised to see an immediate rush to embrace him from Tony Blair. It just seemed unusual. And this is because I am naive, see. I don't really see, I think the two parties might still have some differences between them. And actually, they really don't. You know, we had a very interventionist foreign policy under Bill Clinton. We have a very interventionist foreign policy under George Bush. Obviously, much more militaristic under George Bush, much more ideologically motivated. Certainly, the neoconservatives were unhappy with Bill Clinton. But in many ways, our foreign policy is similar. It's an outward-looking foreign policy. It's a foreign policy that says, how can we change the world to make it meet our standards? So it could be that Tony Blair is happy to do that. It could be that Tony Blair is just, as they say, that, you know, he's an American poodle. I don't know why he does it. Certainly, so, you know, energy issues for, I think energy and the idea that, now you realize when the contracts, when the sanctions would be lifted, which was going to be pretty soon, and under Saddam Hussein, with Saddam Hussein still probably intact, the U.K. also would have been entirely cut out of any contracts by a Hussein-run government. That is very clear, because the U.K. had been with the United States, you know, bombing Iraq for 12 years.
Karen, so, I wanted to tell you we have a phone call.
Okay.
We can take the call now, I guess. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Yeah.
Hi.
Yes.
Hello.
I have two questions. One is as you know, all the internal structure there and the people, what would be the Achilles heels of the neocons inside where you were?
What would be the Achilles heel of the neocons?
By which you mean, what would be the way to defeat them politically, what do you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, Karen, I don't know, what are your thoughts about that?
The Achilles heel of the neocons?
Yeah.
There's a couple of things. I don't know for sure what it would be. I think the truth hurts them. I think the truth hurts. I mean, things like, you know, you see how they came after Richard Clark, how they have gone after guys like Joe Wilson. These people are telling the truth. I mean, I've even had a few flings of an arrow from neoconservative mouthpieces, but certainly the truth.
Yeah, George Will went after you, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah, it's such a shame. They are very upset by objective truth. They, you know, one of the things about the neoconservative, it's been written about quite a bit, is that they are followers of Leo Strauss in many ways. And I don't mean followers, it's that they are blind followers, but they're very much influenced by Straussian thought. And Straussian adored Plato, and he felt that a certain class of people was better qualified to run countries and run government, the philosopher kings. And these people weren't elected, certainly, and they also were superior in almost every way to the common person. And these philosopher kings, as Plato kind of emphasized and as Strauss elaborated, were really authorized to do something called the noble lie, which would be basically say what you need to say to get the masses to follow, because it would all be for their own good. Now, this runs contrary to every value in America, every traditional constitutional value that we hold, every democratic value that we hold. And so I think a little bit of that truth causes people to say, well, you know what? If you're lying, and if you think you're more qualified, and that authorizes you somehow to lie, I reject that. And so we can all reject neoconservatism. In fact, it's very interesting. George Bush ran on his electoral, remember when he got those 49% of the vote or whatever it was he got?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
He ran on a very traditional conservative platform. He said small government, decentralized power.
No nation building.
Humble foreign policy.
No interventionism. I will definitely be the un-Clinton. This is what he ran on, very much a traditional type conservative, paleo-conservative platform. In fact, had he run on a neoconservative platform, which is muscular Wilsonianism, okay, he would have been wholly rejected. You know, the Republicans would not have voted for him because that's not part of what the average conservative has affection for.
So the short answer is speak the truth. And the caller also, I think, had a second.
The caller hung up.
Okay.
He hung up.
I
have a comment on his question as well, which is I think, well, if the things continue to go badly in Iraq and the media continues to report it, then that may be the Achilles heel for the whole administration.
Well, that's definitely, and this is not related to neoconservatism. This is related to any stupid president who does stupid things with the lives of his citizens.
Right.
Clearly, this can break the Bush administration. It won't break neoconservatives because, as you notice, the neoconservatives have taken no responsibility for any of claims that led to this war. They've taken no responsibility for the consequences of this thing. So it won't hurt neoconservatives. It can bring the Bush administration down. But things going bad in Iraq won't hurt neoconservatives.
I was going to change the subject slightly, but one of the topics I'd like to touch on maybe is the media, because one of the things that's disturbed me the most is the whole notion that the whole way the media has responded to this situation. I mean, the becoming a propaganda arm of the government without most of the mainstream outlets have basically been mouthpieces for the government.
Yes, they have been.
And only a couple of papers, and also, of course, the non-mainstream media. But this is kind of what you depend on. There was an old movie, what's that movie, where the end of it, he took his papers and presented them to the New York Times, and that was The Condor, 3 days of The Condor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
New York Times is this, wow, this is the thing that's going to save us, right? The last resort of the outrageous
government.
Instead,
we have Judy Miller, who was in bed with the Middle East Forum.
It turns out to be a complete joke. It's just part of the,
the non-performance or the government, the pro-government performance of our mainstream domestic media is really something that I'm not qualified to really talk on, but I think that we have a big problem. You know, we had the Soviet Union, and of course they had TASS and they had Pravda, right, which were the government organs of media. And there's a story, you could find it out on the internet somewhere, and where media people from America go to the Soviet Union and they say to the senior editors either the senior editors or the government there, and they say it's just amazing how you have you've got the media under control. Under complete control of the politicians, under complete control of the government. And I guess it's something to do with communism. And they said, and we're amazed at how you guys do it without communism.
So
that was long before the Bush administration.
Yeah, these guys are extremely clever about this. That's for sure.
But certainly the Bush administration, some of this is going to backfire on them as well, in that they are very particular about access. They're very particular about if you will be punished. If you are a media outlet and you report badly on the president or ask him a question that is cuts a little bit too close to home or in any other way embarrass the administration, they are very good about punishing those outlets, and really the mainstream media is not independent, certainly financially independent or any other way. And so they basically comply with this. They allow themselves to be manipulated by this administration. However, I don't know if you saw John Dean's article just today discussing some of the things that came out during the Clark testimony on 9/11.
I didn't see it, no.
Yeah, well, the White House actually revealed one of the documents that Thompson, you remember Thompson when he asked the question, he said, here's a book and here's your background testimony, which is true. Remember when he did that? Mm-hmm.
Yes, dramatic? Against Clark.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. Well, I didn't get this at the time, but John Dean wrote about this today, and the document, the background document that they held up was actually a true background document, never intended through the journalistic or the government. You know, it's kind of like a tacit agreement between the government and journalists that I'll give you this on background and I will not be identified.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Well, the government itself, this is in the government's interest to be allowed to provide these things on background.
Yes.
What they did is they outed Clark's name and Clark's particular background document, which is something that's usually not done, and normally that doesn't happen. The journalists don't do it, and the government definitely doesn't do it, because it basically violates the trust and allows you to be unable to use to provide information publicly on background. Well, the White House revealed it in the same way that they revealed Joe Wilson's wife was a non-agent.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, they're ruthless.
They revealed it here, but in doing so, they invalidate their own ability to deal with the press by providing background documents, because people won't, you know, people are not going to trust the government to even honor a tacit agreement with the press. So I think some of this stuff is going to backfire on them, but it is amazing.
Let's hope so.
Yeah, there's another idea that occurred to me the other day, was just this idea that one thing the media, well, it's, I think it's a very good point that they don't want to ask too tough questions, because then these guys won't come to them next time. That's a totally valid point. And also, like in the election coverage is coming up. Mm-hmm. The media doesn't want, what they want is a close election. They don't want a runaway, you know, either direction. They want it to be close. That makes,
sure, makes
people
sense.
Read the articles.
It's a horse race.
More, it makes more advertise more money be spent on advertising in the media and so on. So they want to make sure that Bush doesn't come off as being too terrible. I mean, it would be easy to publish all the stuff we're talking about, emphasize this and explore this and promote this, and it would just kill Bush if this stuff was in the front page every day of the New York Times for the next 6 months.
Really, but it really would. They could so easily do that. In fact, Bush is such an easy target. I mean, almost everything he's done has been an abject failure. And had it been reported in any kind of negative way, you know, it's funny, the media is supposed to be, you're supposed to have this liberal, it's kind of a left-wing bias. Supposedly more media people are registered Democrats than are registered Republicans, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's interesting, because you just don't see that in the Bush administration. I believe that the media probably does have more registered Democrats, but for whatever reason, their personal politics are not affecting what's published.
No, that's right.
Which
so
is interesting.
To finish up, we have about five more minutes. What I'd like to do is go back a little bit toward Iraq and ask you, you know, what's your view of what's going on there now, and what do you think we can look forward to seeing over the next year or 5 years or 10 years, and either from a military or political perspective, whatever you would like. I'm curious as to how you see it shaping up, and what do you think we ought to do? I mean, we're in this mess. Okay, we've got into this mess through fraud and arrogance and duplicity, but now we've got it. So what do we do?
I actually, a lot of people ask me that, people that read my essays, and they say, well, you know, you complain a lot. What is your solution? And I provided it today in my the Military Week op-ed that just was, I think, published this morning. It's out there on the militaryweek.com site. And I provide my layout. But, you know, I think the solution is in those very words that you used. You said fraud and
arrogance and duplicity.
And duplicity.
Well,
okay.
Also incompetence.
Incompetence. Let's not forget incompetence.
Well, incompetence. Sure. And so those four things, fraud, duplicity, arrogance, and incompetence, if those are the keys that got us into this, then how do we unlock those? Well, we unlock those with the opposite. Okay, so first off, you eliminate the fraud. We have fraudulently put in place a handpicked government. Ahmed Chalabi has been very fraudulently, you know, worked his magic on the administration. His family and himself and many others who allied themselves with us here in the States long before we invaded Iraq have been given huge contracts and huge power powerful positions in the future Iraq bureaucracy, and those should all be eliminated. We need to reverse that fraud. That's a fraud that we need to correct with a very much more open and honest competition, and certainly an invalidation of everything that we have granted them. Okay, so that's first off. That's one of the keys. Arrogance, okay? Arrogance has got us into this. What will get us out of this? Humility. Humility will help get us out of this, okay? And that can actually have a play. The fraud part, the military can't do anything about. That's a political question. The arrogance part, the military can do something about. And I think you saw a little bit of this week when we had selected cessation of hostilities with certain towns, mm-hmm. Partly in recognition of the fact that our weapons would kill so many civilians that it would be counterproductive. At least that's my view of why we agreed to these things. And that's a kind of humility. That's a kind of coming to a term. I think we can use a lot more of that to de-escalate some of the hostilities. It's going to take a lot more than that. But humility is another key. Duplicity, obviously, we need to cease the duplicitous nature of our foreign policy. And that includes all of the Middle East. If we're going to hate dictators, then we need to hate all dictators. If we're going to support dictators, then we need to be upfront with that, okay? And we're not either. We have not done either. I mean, you've got guys like Rumsfeld singing the praises of the dictator of Kazakhstan and saying that this is how we want all countries to be. I mean, this is ludicrous, okay? And it doesn't go unnoticed by the rest of the world.
All right. We have less than a minute remaining, so if you can...
But I think that if we can approach it this way, I definitely think that we should, have competence in our foreign policy and basically get out of Iraq as quickly and as efficiently as we possibly can with a kind of consciousness of what we can do to help fix the problems that we ourselves have created for the Iraqi people.
Thank you. If you would hold on for a minute, Karen. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Our guest today has been Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kotowski, who is retired from the Air Force, worked in the Pentagon. I encourage you to look to read her writings. You can get them by Googling for Karen Kotowski. It's KWIATKOWSKI, or just look at leftout.info, and the links are there. She's really a wonderful writer, and I encourage you to look at her work. Let's see. The other thing we wanted to mention was the Newsweek.
Right, yes. Next week at this time, our show alternates with a show called Headlines with Elaine Newton, and so we encourage you to tune in next week at 6 o'clock at this time for Headlines.
Okay, and thank you, Karen, and thank you all for listening. You've been listening to Left Out on WRCT.